So we'll start with the military base in Vanuatu. Why do you think China has made a move to create a new military base in the Asia Pacific region?
Look, I think we should wait until we have confirmation that this is actually what's going to happen. I think that's probably a bit of a big step. If you read the Sinimon Herald article, it's a little bit vague on details in that there aren't any on-the-record sources, and people talk about it happening incrementally, which is extremely hard to disprove because you're projecting forward to what might happen. I've been on the record myself as saying it's something that could happen within the next 5 to 10 years, and it wouldn't surprise me. I am a little bit surprised that it would be in Vanuatu, though. That doesn't seem to be the most strategic location you would choose for a military base. But it would send an incredibly powerful message to the US and to Australia, and quite an aggressive message were it to be in Vanuatu, because it's so close to Australia's shores.
Ralph Kosser, who is the co-chair of the Council for Security Cooperation in the Asia Pacific, has been quoted as saying China's moves are probably more psychological than strategic. Do you agree with that sentiment?
That's a very good way of putting it. I mean, I agree in that Vanuatu is not an obviously strategic choice for a base, in that, you know, it's not terribly close to any major shipping lanes that you'd be looking to protect with a base. It's not really a part of the world that sees a great deal of shipping traffic at all, or, you know, terribly sensitive submarine movements or anything like that. So it would be, if it were to come into fruition, I think it's still a big if the Luganville Wharf were to move to dual use and then move to a fully fledged military base, that would be an incredibly aggressive message, and without necessarily having a great deal of practical application, in terms of its military strategy. So I think he's pretty well on the money there.
And what do you think China is trying to get out of these expansive moves into the Asia Pacific? In the last 13 years, they spent $2.3 billion in aid in the region. What are they hoping to get from this?
Well, it's worth keeping that in perspective. They may have spent $2.3 billion, but it's still considerably less than the amount of aid that Australia would have spent in the region over that period, including, you know, Australia outspends China in Vanuatu, for example. What do they want as a quid pro quo? There's a famous quote, Dan McGarry from the Villa Post is on the record as saying he heard the Chinese ambassador in Vanuatu say there's no such thing as free lunch, in reference to debts that Vanuatu held in the form of China Exim Bank loans. Now, we have to trust Dan on that. If the Chinese ambassador was sufficiently indiscreet to actually utter these words, then that would indicate they expect something in return for their aid, which is largely in the form of concessional loans rather than grants, so that, it, you know, while initially you have some infrastructure built, you have a debt to pay down the line, and in a way, a debt that you might want to see forgiven down the line. So that gives you leverage that giving aid in the form of grants simply doesn't do. So what that really allows, the no free lunch scenario, allows you to put pressure on things such as recognizing China's position in the South China Sea, which Vanuatu is the first Pacific nation to do so. You could use it in other ways in different international forums to get votes, to put pressure on Taiwan, to achieve any number of international goals that China has. But will they call that in all the time? I don't think that would be very sensible on their part, because after a while, the smaller countries will simply say, look, one, don't push us around, and two, yeah, you've made that threat before.
Now, you mentioned Australia just there. Do you think China has the space to make these moves because of an Australian retreat from the area?
Look, I mean, it's very interesting in the case of Vanuatu, in that if you look at, say, for example, the Vanuatu Prime Minister, he's visited China twice and is yet to make an official visit to Australia, which sends quite a significant signal. I think, you know, there need to be some serious efforts made. I don't know what reason there is that he hasn't managed to pay an official visit to Australia, whether it's on our side or their side. But this is definitely something that needs to be looked at, because, you know, diplomatic visits are in some ways still a measure of the health of a relationship. That said, I think in terms of on the security side, we are, as Julie Bishop says, still Vanuatu's strategic partner of choice because of the compatibility of our militaries, because of historical ties, and just because of the geography. We're a lot closer to Vanuatu than China is.
And there have been members of the Australian Parliament, mainly on the Liberal side, such as Concetta Fioraventi-Wells and Andrew Hastie, who have made comments in a negative light on the Chinese expansion in the region. Do you think these comments are useful in bettering Australia's position in the region?
The comments themselves, I don't think, are tremendously useful in that, you know, no one particularly likes being called out for having a dud aid program, in the case of Fioraventi-Wells' comments about China's aid to the Pacific. You know, they don't really advance things because in many ways, if you want to build closer ties with China, the way to do it is to look towards cooperation. And aid is one of those areas where there are obvious areas where Australia and China can work together in the Pacific. And if you talk to people within the Chinese aid community, they're, one, quite keen to see Australia, you know, continue to take the lead and New Zealand to continue to take the lead in the Pacific in terms of development cooperation. And also, there isn't the knowledge base in China about the Pacific to really allow China to credibly, you know, really extend its influence, that they simply don't have the historical ties and the knowledge about the Pacific region. They're not there yet by a long shot. So I'm skeptical that they would see the Pacific anywhere high on their sort of list of priorities of areas to engage with. It's well behind Africa and well behind the Americas.
Well, just finally, you know, we've spoken about military moves, soft power moves, and China's growing influence in the region. Do you think that 50 years down the line, when all this kind of stuff has formed into more influence from China in the region, do you think that Australia might have to worry about the influence of another superpower nation, not that Australia is, but another superpower nation right on their doorstep in the Pacific?
I mean, what was that great quote from Ross Gardner from a couple of years ago? It got used again last night in a lecture, and I think Ross said, "I refuse to accept that Australia is a pissant nation," which is I don't know if you can use that on air. But so I think in 50 years from now, if you're starting to do projections, I mean, the interesting if you look at rising powers other than China, which obviously grabs all the headlines, certainly India. Will be very interesting in the region in terms of it having ties, particularly to Fiji, and it being a power that explicitly defines itself in opposition to China. One of the few countries to outright reject the Belt and Road Initiative and simply say we want nothing to do with it. So that will be an interesting rivalry, I think, in our region, because India does have some genuine historic ties, particularly to Fiji.
Right. Well, Graham, thanks so much for your time.